This is the second instalment of a five-part interview with Cory Doctorow, conducted by Rachel Baker and Charles Beckett of Arts Council England. Here, Baker and Beckett get Cory's opinion on anachronistic art practice, replication, and the death of the unique object.
The examples that are often presented to people in general, i.e. your book, Little Brother, and Jamie King's Steal This Film, as examples of, you know, online distribution of cultural content and presented as free cultural content. What I've noticed about these experiments is that they tend to be creations by artists who are already interested in the technology and the politics of this space. They're not necessarily, I mean, a lot of the film and people who are experimenting with this are making films that have a kind of social issues at their heart. You know, a lot of documentary filmmakers are experimenting with this form. And again, with your book, the content of the book is about hacker culture. It's about, it's the form follows the content, if you see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Mainstream content or products, cultural products, they're not necessarily about the form of the networked culture. Are they going to have a harder time?
Also, I think one of the most successful people in the world of pre-online distribution is a guy who's a banjo player, who's distributed material about how to play the banjo. So I don't know that that's entirely true. But I think that when you're talking about material that's meant to be, you know, that's meant to have artistic merit and kind of roll back into a kind of cultural discourse, it's very difficult to conduct a cultural discourse in the 21st century that doesn't touch on networks and network communications, regardless of what you're writing. If you're writing a book set in the 20th century that's a straight-ahead bodice ripper, your characters are still going to be exchanging MASH emails with one another, right? So it's in some ways, it's not just the form follows the content, but it's the, or form follows the subject, rather. It's that the overwhelming subject of the 21st century is network communication so far. And so it's impossible to talk about Iran without talking about Twitter. It's impossible to, I saw your green armband there. It's impossible to talk about the last election without talking about the internet, or the election before. It's impossible to talk about Al-Qaeda without talking about the internet. It's impossible to talk about wiretapping privacy CCTV without talking about the internet. So it's hard to imagine a subject, right? Environmentalism, globalism, global trade, all of these things swirl around the network. And then, of course, at the one of the nexi of this are people whose vision of where their income would come from as when they were growing up, or whose historic income sources have come from excluding people from information, right? So I will make a book and there will be enough technology to distribute the book, but not enough technology to distribute the book without my permission. This is the kind of the thing that a lot of us believed growing up. I will make a movie and there'll be enough technology to maybe put a video on demand in your sitting room, but not enough that you can then record it, put it on the internet, and share it with 20 million people. I call it the fallacy of just enough technology. And for us, living in our bubble of having grown up expecting this much technology and no further, what technology has done is of a great deal of interest, whether it's something we dread or something that we celebrate. People who are engaged in the creative arts, who are making media that is either intended to be copied or is copied without them intending it, find themselves returning again and again to this subject, inside and outside the mainstream. EastEnders has plots about the internet. It's you can't get away from it.
Mm. I mean, you said quite controversially in your blog text that artists that were making work that was against being reproduced were making art of the past. I mean, that was a
If you're making art without the intention of having it copied in the 21st century, you're not making contemporary art. You're making anachronistic art.
That's a very controversial statement, particularly in the visual arts. I mean, the contemporary visual arts world is still, because of the art market, predicated on the unique object. So it's going to take monumental. Well, I suspect, you know, you need a few kind of breakthrough artists, maybe coming through the media art or internet art scene, to prove that you can build a sort of successful cultural infrastructure.
It may be that the distribution curve of visual arts income will be different shape. So it may not be Damien Hirst shape, right? And by the middle of the 21st century, it may be shaped more like a bell curve. It may be shaped more like an inverse power curve. It may be shaped like a power curve. There, all of those are legitimate shapes for an art market to have, and you can see them. You know, you can kind of see that poetry at one point looked like one shape, and now it looks like another in terms of the distribution of income and readership, fame, and the ability to become a full-time poet. Other kinds of visual art have kind of risen and fallen as time has gone by. And at every turn, I think that people quite rightly felt that this was an existential threat to their kind of production. But I guess for me, if I'm going to take off my Cory Doctorow hat and put on my sim regulator hat and say, okay, I'm the Minister of Culture, what am I going to do after they finish raking me over the coals for my expenses? What I want to do is make a policy that allows for maximum participation in culture, not for maximum income for some people who make culture. So in other words, if we were given two completely polar futures, one that we can attain through policy outcomes. One is a world in which no one makes any money, but everybody makes art. And another one in which a very few number of people make art, and they make a lot of money for it. I think that the responsible role of a regulator is to take the first one. Those are artificially polarized examples. I think that the actual fact is that there will always be some people who make something like a modest living. There will always be a couple of people who are vast outliers who make giant amounts of money, but whose economics are completely not derived from what we think of as copyright. And then there'll be the vast majority who create either with the hope of earning a living or just for the exuberant possibility of creation, who will never earn a living, just like the history of the arts from the beginning, because art's always been irrational and most artists have never earned a living at it. And so for me, the question is, what can we do, A, to maximize the income of everyone, but B, much more importantly, what can we do to maximize the expressivity of everyone to ensure that anyone who's got an audience can find that audience? Because I don't think we'll ever make enough money from the arts until we reach like cyber utopia, in which there's just an infinite amount of money for everyone. We're never going to have enough money to give everyone who wants to be an artist a full-time living at it. But we may be able to attain, in my lifetime, the capacity for everyone who wants to make art to find their audience for their work. And so, you know, while it'd be nice to have the first one, I think the second one's way more important and attainable.